I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Philadelphia's police department is struggling to reform its stop and frisk program, according to a new report. The data shows nearly 7 of 10 stops last year were of black residents, and many of those interactions were unconstitutional. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the police department is promising to make big changes to the city's stop and frisk policy, but falling short of saying it will completely end.
To get a real sense of what it means that Philly police officers stop 200,000 pedestrians a year, talk to Arthur Schinholster. On a recent Sunday evening, he was strolling out of a store holding grocery bags on his way to visit his grandkids in Southwest Philadelphia when he heard someone screaming at him.
Get on the ground. What do you mean get on? I'm walking around in a three-piece suit. You want to tell me to get on the ground for what? Do I look like I want to get on the ground to you? I don't think so.
The incident shook him up. As he was talking to me, though, he eyed up my recording gear and paused.
You look suspicious. I'll be walking around looking at you. I will stop and frisk you. Why? Because you got headphones, a microphone. Who are you?
Well, as a white guy, I'm in the minority of pedestrians who are stopped and frisked by police every year. That's according to David Rudofsky, who is the lead attorney on the 2010 ACLU lawsuit that prompted the periodic reviews. The latest report finds that in 2015, officers stopped black residents far more than their white counterparts. Weapons were recovered less than 1% of the time. A third of all the stops were done without thinking somebody is suspicious. And Rudofsky says that's illegal.
It's beyond a question of training and review. We're now at the point of accountability. This won't change unless officers and supervisors in the department who are not following the rules are held accountable.
For his part, new police commissioner Richard Ross says change is on the horizon. Captains will look at stop and frisk reports every day instead of quarterly and increase stop and frisk audits.
I can stand before you right now and tell you just about anything, but we'll have to see what the numbers bear out in the quarters that are coming up.
Stop and frisk was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1968. It just got controversial when groups began to notice that those guidelines aren't being followed and that minorities are targeted more than anyone else. In Philadelphia, though, most violent crime happens in black communities, Ross says. So what neighborhoods do you think should be heavily policed?
It is a law enforcement tool that arises out of a federal court case from many, many years ago. And if you were to take that away from police officers, you would have chaos on the streets of this nation, not just here.
Clem Harris, professor of African American studies at Wesleyan University, says high poverty and low education rates are to blame. That old Supreme Court case, Harris says it's given police a lot of power.
Without realizing that the outcome of those types of stops increases the degree of aggravation and agitation among particular communities that are hard hit by them.
Former Mayor Michael Nutter was a defender of stop and frisk. He said it helped cut crime. In the backdrop of less city violence, Mayor Jim Kenney campaigned on ending stop and frisk, which was celebrated by black community leaders. Now his administration's policy papers call for a more dramatic overhaul of the tactic. Kenney issued a statement praising police reforms as a tremendous step forward in police-community relations. Rudofsky says Kenney and the police department are now being closely watched.
We're willing to give this administration some time to make these corrections. They don't have a lot of time.
Schinholster, meanwhile, says what stuck with him more than anything else was that the officer who stopped and patted him down said he looked like a robbery suspect in the area, with curly hair and light complexion, a guy from Ohio. That definitely wasn't him.
I ain't never been to Ohio. You know, I'm like, yo, what do you want? He said, what do you got? What do you got on you? I ain't got nothing on me. He said, well, you know, we allowed to stop and frisk you. I said, for real?
Now the question is, if captains have to check in every day about how patrol officers are stopping pedestrians, will the numbers finally change? For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
For 3 weeks next month, the government of Atlantic City is planning to shut down. City Hall will no longer be able to pay its bills or its workers. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, it comes as New Jersey lawmakers continue squabbling over how to help the distressed resort town.
Atlantic City Mayor Don Guardian asked the state for a loan to squeak by until the city gets tax payments in early May, but that wasn't going to fly. Governor Chris Christie, who supports a state takeover of Atlantic City, used news of the impending shutdown to highlight why he thinks the city needs help from Trenton.
I am not going to permit the people of this state to be held responsible and have their pocketbooks picked again by Atlantic City.
The takeover bill has support in the state Senate, but the assembly is a different story. Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto says he opposes the current version of the bill, which contains a provision that would let the state cancel collective bargaining agreements.
They would be exempt from unfair labor practices. You know, a statement like that is unconscionable to me.
But Christie says he will only sign the takeover bill in its current form, so that fight is expected to continue. Atlantic City's government shutdown will start Friday, April 8th, and is expected to end by May 2nd. Non-essential employees will be sent home, but police, firefighters, and sanitation workers will stay on the job. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
It's a day of mourning for Belgian citizens living in both the country and abroad. Belgian police are conducting raids across the country following today's bombings at a Brussels metro station that killed more than 30 people. Flights into and out of the city have been canceled indefinitely. In Philadelphia, transit police have been increasing patrols at SEPTA stations, says SEPTA Police Chief Thomas Nestel.
We want to make sure that our riders here in Philadelphia feel safe and secure.
Those in our region with Belgian connections are reaching out to friends and loved ones. Michael Nessins, a third-generation American of Belgian descent, owns Eulogy Belgian Tavern in Philadelphia. He says he only heard about the bombing from a reporter who called him this morning seeking comment.
And I looked, I said, oh, my God, no. And, you know, I didn't know what was going on, who was hurt. I have a lot of friends in the brewing industry over there, so and I still have a lot of friends and who I used to work with when I was over there. And so my concern was, well, who was hurt and so forth.
Nessen says he's been able to reach friends and relatives. Belgium doesn't have a consulate in Philadelphia, and Nessen says there isn't much of an expat community here.
I always joke there's like 12 Belgians in the Philadelphia area, and they're all my family. You know, it's not too many of us.
Asked whether he'll do anything tonight to honor the victims of the bombing, Nessen says the best way to honor them is to keep living life normally.
We're going to go on as usual, just like the people over there hopefully will.
Still ahead, water utilities have to test for lead levels, but the nature of lead contamination makes it difficult to know how the levels vary citywide.
Their technique is not to protect the individual, it's to protect the general population.
That's coming up when NewsWorks Tonight continues.
Recent low oil prices haven't meant good news for everyone. For workers in the oil-rich Scottish city of Aberdeen, it's actually bringing boatloads of bad news.
I think it's shocked a lot of people that it's happened so quickly and so dramatically. I certainly did not expect it to be this, you know, brutal and aggressive, and that really has shocked me.
I'm Molly Wood. What happened to Aberdeen? That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers Camden School of Business MBA program, a flexible MBA program designed to meet the individual needs of working professionals. Class is held in the evening Monday through Thursday and during the day on Saturday in Camden and Cherry Hill, offering rolling admission and accepting applications for summer and fall. An info session is Wednesday, March 23rd at 6 p.m. at Camden County College on Route 70 in Cherry Hill at business.camden.rutgers.edu or 856-225-6452.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Tom McDonald in for Dave Heller. The federal lead and copper rule requires utilities around the U.S. to test residents' tap water for lead levels. But even as systems test results meet the Environmental Protection Agency standards under the rule, it doesn't necessarily mean every home's water is safe. And basic information that could help target water quality testing is often missing. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zoroff explains.
On a recent afternoon, I went over to a private lab that tests water for contaminants. I wanted to know the lead levels in my drinking water.
Are you putting it at the bottom?
Yes. First thing next morning, I trudged downstairs to the kitchen with my sample bottle. I'm going to open it. So I'm going to turn on my water. Okay, I got my water in there, so I'm going to seal it up. We'll see what they say. On the way to work, I dropped the sample off at the lab. If you live in almost any Pennsylvania city, I recommend you try this little exercise as well. Why? Let's start from the beginning. The EPA requires utilities to deliver safe water to people's homes. Utilities check water for most contaminants at the treatment facility before it enters the distribution system and flows into people's homes. Lead is different.
The big difference is where the test is done, and it's at the customer's tap.
That's Jim Good, who until recently was executive director of the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. Why the difference?
Where the lead comes into the water is when it leaches out from the service line and then the indoor plumbing.
Service lines run perpendicular to the water main in the street, connecting it to individual homes. They're usually owned by the homeowner. So even treated lead-free water could become contaminated by the homeowner's own lead line before hitting the tap. To minimize the chances of that happening, operators at the plant add chemicals to make the water less corrosive. That's where the EPA's lead and copper rule tests come in. Abigail Cantor is a chemical engineer who owns a consulting firm specializing in drinking water quality.
The goal is to understand if a water system has the potential to leach lead or copper. And it's from the perspective of an engineering control as opposed to health risk.
She says no one has figured out a way to get a complete picture of lead levels across the city without testing every home. Instead, the testing checks if the corrosion controls are working.
Every plumbing system is different. And you may be in a house and that testing protocol doesn't necessarily protect you. So their technique is not to protect the individual, it's to protect the general population.
Pennsylvania has many lead lines. EPA requires its largest cities, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, to sample just 50 houses every 3 years. In 2013, in Pittsburgh, 10% of samples tested above EPA's threshold for action. But the sample size is too small to extrapolate the results. No one knows what percentage of homes citywide could have elevated lead levels. In other words, having lead lines doesn't mean you have bad water, but the EPA tests offer no assurances citywide. As a precaution, EPA requires utilities to test the most vulnerable homes with known lead service lines. Here's the EPA's Director of Ground and Drinking Water, Peter Gravatt.
I think it's very important to make sure that systems are in fact going to the sites where they expect to find the highest levels of lead and copper. The belief was when EPA wrote this rule back in 1991 that that would be a protective approach for communities.
To make that possible, EPA requires water utilities to survey the materials in their distribution systems. But neither Philadelphia nor Pittsburgh has a comprehensive materials inventory that includes lead lines. Jim Good again in Pittsburgh.
We don't have the exact number and location. We've never actually surveyed that.
It's the same deal in Philadelphia. Service lines there are entirely private, and the utility does not consider them its responsibility. But both EPA and the State Department of Environmental Protection say ownership is not a consideration. A DEP spokesman says the agency requires a comprehensive inventory that includes identifying lead service lines. Other guidance suggests what's important is having a sufficient inventory to be able to sample enough sites with lead piping. But without a comprehensive inventory, targeting can be limited. The Pittsburgh utility, for instance, sends letters to people who previously participated in testing and relies on random respondents to bill stuffers.
But we do ask, you know, homeowners, we ask them, well, do you have lead? And sometimes they know. So then that helps meet the criteria.
PWSA and PWD are looking into doing a full inventory of pipes in their cities and are starting to evaluate what it would take to replace all lead lines in their coverage areas. And PWSA is considering increasing testing frequency. The EPA is also revising the lead and copper rule, which could include new testing protocols. Meanwhile, both cities offer free lead testing to their customers. That's in addition to the testing they're required to do. My test from the private lab took about a week to come back. When I received my results, I called Janet Stout.
I'm a microbiologist and president of Special Pathogens Laboratory in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
So could you tell me what my test results actually mean?
The sample that was collected from the kitchen shows levels of lead that are below the Environmental Protection Agency action limit.
My sample showed 2 parts per billion of lead. The EPA limit is 15 parts per billion. That number, by the way, is not based on safety, but
rather on what's achievable with proper anti-corrosion control. My results are good news for me, but it doesn't mean my city's water is good or even my neighbor's. Irina Zhorov, Keystone Crossroads.
And Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Philadelphia is a city of evolving neighborhoods. What some of those sections evolved from is the topic taken up in Roots of Hypersegregation in Philadelphia, 1920 to 1930. It's an article for the Philadelphia History blog by Ken Finkel. He's professor in American Studies and Public History at Temple University. He spoke with Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller.
Let's start with a definition. What's hypersegregation?
I think we all have a sense of what segregation is, but hypersegregation takes it to a new level, extends it more deeply into the way in which the city is laid out. It's spatial, it's historical. Doug Massey and Jonathan Tannen at Princeton have recently written an update. Massey's article originally defined it back in 1989, and he said it was where populations were uneven and isolated and concentrated and centralized and in clusters. There's a number of different nuanced measures, and he and his team have looked at a number of cities across the country and tracked over the decades the way in which these neighborhoods and these habits of settlement and decline have led to issues that the cities should be facing up to.
What about the 1920s fostered the number of variables that led to these factors producing hyper-segregation?
Sure. Well, the issue of African-American neighborhoods actually goes back to the 19th century in Philadelphia, and it became much more of a large issue in the 1920s because of the sheer numbers were growing.
Migration from the South.
Migration from the South at the very time that immigration from Europe had collapsed as a result
of World War I.
World War I and policies. And so, for
can
instance,
we factor in a boll weevil?
A boll weevil affected the failure of crops in the South, and so people were literally getting on the train, leaving the fields, and it was truly a great migration. The vast majority of African Americans in the United States were Southern and rural and agricultural. And during the 19 teens and the first half of the 20s, close to a million left and went to northern cities. And Philadelphia had long been a destination for people coming from all over the world.
Put Philadelphia, though, in the broader context. I understand the Princeton study looked at some 40 hyper-segregated sections of cities.
And Milwaukee turns out now to be the one in the worst shape. So I guess we could be pleased that we're moving in the right direction. But Philadelphia is tied with Baltimore for number 10, which puts us behind Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Detroit. Flint is there. It's actually a wonderful measure to have. But really what, as a historian, I do and what I urge people to do is to look at the stories of what makes those particular places the way they are, because, in fact, Philadelphia's neighborhoods have their own characteristics.
What are some suggestions on how to go about looking at those stories?
Sure. Well, one of the neighborhoods that is undergoing a certain revival right now is Sharswood, north of Girard College. It's in the heart of North Philadelphia. Most Philadelphians have never gone through, never taken a look at it. What can we do to help move this neighborhood into the 21st century in a way that respects the past? Philadelphia's a city of homes. It's a city of history. It's a city where there's a great deal of legacy. I'll give you an example. There's a recreation center around 28th and Master called Athletic Park. There's nothing right now that would tell you what happened there. In 1876, that was the site of the first National League baseball game. A few years before that, 1867, that was the site of the first game between a black team and a white team in baseball on those fields. Wouldn't it be great if they were to hear about their neighborhood's history and not think of it as blighted, as needing help, that in fact it has something to offer the city?
Ken Finkel, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Glad to be here, Dave.
Ken Finkel, professor of American Studies and Public History at Temple University, and he blogs for phillyhistory.org. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org.
Finally, sometimes the potential reward of an action outweighs the risk, but it's hard to see it that way in the case of Stephon Noble. After being charged with contempt of court during his bail hearing, Noble fled the courtroom, causing a brief lockdown at Philadelphia's Criminal Justice Center. Noble was facing charges of terroristic threats and retail theft. However, being on the sixth floor of the building, Noble was effectively penned in, and authorities found him shortly after he fled, hiding in a bathroom. It's not whether attempting escape will be added to the list of charges. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. With HIV infection rates in gay black men in Philadelphia expected to rise dramatically, public health officials are gearing up with plans to distribute a new preventative medication. We'll have that story on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. Sitting in for Dave Heller, I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.